You're listening to Good Sentences, the podcast that's guaranteed to tickle your literary ear holes and make you wish you'd listened to dear old mom when she said to put down those lawn darts and learn how to read. And now, here are your hosts, neither of whom listened to dear old mom. This is Craig A. Hart and S.J. Varengo.
Well, thank you both for agreeing to do this. Scott has to because...
Yes, I'm contractually obligated.
But Evelina
Not that I would have missed it for the world, but...
Right. No, but this is great. Some of the listeners to the Good Sentences podcast have come over from the Games and Writers show that you were on, so they may remember you from there. But for those that are new, Evelina Delane is a pianist and a world record holder and now an author. And so I'm really looking forward to her book is finished in Russian, right? And you're going to have it translated into English?
Yeah, I have about 55% of it already in English.
Awesome. Yeah, well, we can't wait to read that and talk about that. It'll be great. You and I had a pretty, a fairly brief discussion about it the other day. Mm. And that sort of our discussion about that then kind of spawned the idea to do a podcast about it, in particular, the effect of art on human development. One of the issues that I get concerned about in terms of public education in particular is that they tend to be doing away with a lot of the arts and humanities in favor of STEM programs, which obviously science, technology, whatnot, those are all great and needed. But I am concerned, and maybe Scott can jump in on this, that at the expense of the art and humanities, because we are human beings. And I think those classes like music and literature, those teach us how to be human, and they teach us how to empathize with other human beings and experience other points of view outside of our own experience.
Yeah, I think, the world that we're seeing outside our window right now demonstrates that really well. I think the loss of emphasis on the humanities and on being human, is right. Very evident in the world right now.
When you take away things like music and literature, and Evelina, of course, can speak to music in particular, and art is a lot in Scott's wheelhouse as well. I'm just here for the ride. I know nothing. So I have nothing to contribute whatsoever. But I do feel that in the absence of those things, you're left with nothing but cold, hard logic, which has its place. But there is a place for emotion and a place for more abstract thinking that can create some of the beauty in the human experience.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure you're left with logic as well because not everybody has logic. So automatically, because they're devoid of art, they wouldn't become logical as well. So
right.
It might be left with, a personality that is not really rounded, but neither is logical.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. And logic is one of those great words that, everybody talks about it like we all have it, but common sense, that's the other one, should not be called common sense because it's very uncommon.
True.
True.
Yeah, I did I did a lot of research for my book advocating for art education. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of research starting with pre-Socratic philosophers. Mm-hmm. For example, there was a philosopher before Socrates called Phalles. Phalles of the city called Miletus, I think. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, he was adamant that art is no less important than logic and science and math and because he was very focused on development of spiritual side of the person. Well, right. He thought actually spirit comes from water. So everything spiritual comes from water, which is a very interesting point of view that I'm researching. So the thing is, he was basically, his notion was carried on into Socratic school, Platonic school, even Stoics that were not so much into art, they still appreciated it. And then it just carried on. Interestingly, a lot of those philosophers, like the most famous ones, the Plato and Socrates, they didn't like they didn't like a lot of art. They only liked very specific parts of art. And they, to the point where Plato said that if we break the rules of music, we will destroy the country's order.
Which actually
shows you how much he actually valued the power of music, right?
Right.
He thought if you're just gonna like play the song not in how they used to, but in any new way, you're gonna create a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it just serves to tell you how much power they placed on art. So they didn't appreciate all art. Plato didn't like theater, for example. He was against it. So they had a lot of different philosophies going on between them. But what they never doubted is the power of art, the power of human expression through things other than math, other than logic. They did consider art education absolutely necessary to be able to express yourself in math and geometry and astronomy and philosophy and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah, I think that ability to view those things as a whole and interconnected with each other is what I fear we're losing. It's like, you know, there are people divide them into two things and then they make a decision about which is more important based on funding availability. But the children miss out. And how can you be a fully rounded human without the influence of art on your life? I can't quite wrap my head around that.
I would be a little cautious giving any credence to anyone's philosophy that excludes art, because let's take a specific example. In the United States today, the ruling group is very focused on economy. And so every decision they make, that's the linchpin of the decision. So that trickles down into education, and we focus on the things that make money. And then what we're doing is we're producing a generation of moneymakers with no soul.
Right.
And that's not just bad, that's dangerous.
Well, I'm always, I think, and Scott can back me up on this, I'm a proponent of the long game. Mm-hmm. And I consider a focus on arts and humanities to be a long game. You may not see the results as quickly as somebody, say, finishes college, they go out, they make six figures a year.
Right.
But the art and humanity, if somebody's well-rounded in that way, they will have a positive, or at least they have a much greater chance of being, a positive influence on their community forever, for the rest of their lives. And you may not see the results of it right away, but ultimately, it's going to make the world a lot better place to live in. I did want to bring up one thing. I talked with Evelina about this and some of the work she's doing with music therapy, and she was telling me something about the effects that has had on people.
Yes, I do a few different types of music therapy, and I find it extremely effective. One of them is connected to bringing in peak states or desired states, high performance states. Mm. So what I do, I actually put people underneath this piano. I give them a little guidance based on a few techniques that I use in terms of being ecological towards people's content. Mm-hmm. So I try not to be too strong with my guidance. So most of the work is done by music. And when I play specially selected pieces. And then you lie under the piano on the hardwood floor, the vibration goes through you, mm-hmm. and you get into quite a few different altered states, which I actually know how to maintain or how to swap for a person. So, and that creates a lot of powerful changes in a person. I can create almost any state with that type of music therapy. I called it inside the music, because you are literally inside the music. Mm-hmm. That thing has been very strong, very powerful. It works with any two people, because what it creates a very strong vibration. And when I say vibration, I don't mean it in any new age type vibration. I mean the physical vibration.
Right, right.
You are vibrating on the same frequencies as the piano is vibrating, the floor is vibrating, right? So you do feel the physical vibration go through your body. And obviously, because you're under the piano and it's so resonant, then you do feel kind of the weight of the sound going into you. So this is a physical type of experience, right? But as we know, experience resides in the body, right? As we know, trauma resides in the body, or positive emotions, they reside in the body first, right?
Right.
So basically what we're doing, so here what I'm trying to create, I am making people embody the vibrations that come from the outside, you know, the frequencies, the physical, you know, frequencies that we can measure, that we can, you know, okay, we can't see them, but we can measure them, right? But then what happens is that those frequencies, those vibrations, they kind of transform into those metaphoric vibrations that we like to use when we say higher vibration.
Right.
We say like positive vibration. So basically, first your body starts kind of experiencing the changed states, various states, and then your mind and your limbic system gets activated. And basically, I can somewhat control this process to bring in a desired state and also anchor it with some special, because I know basically what keys to use and stuff like that. So that one is a one part of my music therapy is inside the music. And another part of the music therapy that I use is I work with children with developmental problems. Mm-hmm. Some of them have late speech development. Some of them have uncoordinated type of movement in their body. You know, for example, one of the hemispheres is stronger than the other usually, right?
Sure, right.
You know, so left didn't have time to catch up, right? And stuff like that. And so so those children who at the age of 4, 5, 6, 7, they do not have full control of their speech, and sometimes they do not have full independent control of the opposite sides of their body. And what I found is that there is a very specific type of educating them in piano that I can use to very effectively create the connections between the hemispheres,
right?
To the point where I can also create almost any state I want in them, and I do, and I can predict, you know, what letter they're going to say next, you know, what movement is going to appear next, how coordinated they will become. I can also alter their mood with that type of thing. For example, when children have late speech development, they get angry easily, right? Because they can't express themselves.
They're frustrated,
Yes. And then it becomes anchored, that frustration, that anger becomes anchored. And you often see people with children on autistic spectrum that are tantruming children, right? They're in constant state of tantrum, and it becomes a common knowledge. Oh, he's autistic, so he's angry or something like that, right? Whereas we forget that initially that kind of tantrum reaction came from this child not being able to express themselves.
Right.
And to be able to be heard and understood. And then those children are already frustrated because first they can't express themselves. And second, when they try to express themselves, a lot of people don't have the patience to wait for the end of that very forced sentence.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
Even parents dismiss them when children stutter, or when children don't have command of language. And so like, if somebody's trying to get out a sentence for 5 minutes, you know, they get dismissed. And so, and then it turns into this spiral where we forget that initially their mood, their bad moods, they came from that, from the frustration based on communication. And now we're not dealing with the initial problem. We are now dealing, say, oh, this child needs mood altering something.
Right.
Like something is wrong with his mood. He can't control himself. He does tantrums and stuff like that. So basically what I do, instead of dealing with the actual tantrums and moods and stuff like that, I go back to them being able to express themselves. And, you know, I teach them to play, not for the sake of them becoming pianists, but because I know how the fine motorics of the fingers are connected to the speech development in the brain. The speech develops, the mood stabilizes, right? The speech develops, the mood stabilizes. I do a lot of cross hands work, right? Because obviously I want that connection between the hemispheres to strengthen, right? And then And then basically what we do, we grow a lot of connections, right? Well, a lot of new synaptic connections.
All right.
And when that happens during the year, this child completely transforms. You know, the tantrums disappear. You know, the speech becomes, you know, well, audible. You know, you can understand what the child is saying. They usually fall in love with music because now they know that's what made them being able to express themselves. Right. And then as a result, the whole family system transforms.
Yeah.
Because you can see that before, everybody was frustrated with everybody. So you can see through this child studying music, essentially, in a year, the whole family system is transformed. People are reading more, people are talking more. And it's a kind of like now the new spiral. And now this child's life may have been forever altered because now this child will be able to study at school better, will be able to express himself better with his peers, will be able to get teachers' attention easier. And so now I can see that sometimes I create those changes that I can see in 20 years will make this child a president or something.
Right, right.
Yeah. What is your history with it? Like, how did you develop, discover, and learn this technique?
I think I made it up through the years of... Well, because I have a unique history of being a pianist, but also dealing with a lot of trauma in my life, which made me research into clinical psychology and through clinical psychology to various psychotherapeutic techniques. Mm-hmm. So I've been in psychotherapy development, learning, studying psychotherapy since I was 24. So it's 19 years ago. Mm-hmm. And basically, I think I am in a unique position as a person who studied music my entire life. But then through my own trials and tribulations, I was forced to study mood. I was forced to study states. I was forced to study neurobiology. Okay, I'm not a scientist, but I know enough about synaptic connections to even predict what I can do to grow a new synaptic connection in myself or in the child or in my client. Mm-hmm. So what happened with me was that I've started putting those things together for the last 15 years, you know. Mm-hmm. For a while, I worked separately as a musician and separately as a coach.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I would not connect them. I would use my, my personality is interconnected. So I probably would use my art-based revelations when working with clients. But I would not connect them into like a music-based therapy or art-based therapy.
Right.
I've only started doing that maybe 4 years ago because I've read enough and I've kind of developed enough to see the direct results of what I'm doing. And I have some very special type of intuition where I look at the child, I kind of know what stage development they're in, mm-hmm. what kind of brain problems they have, you know, if there is not enough, you know, connections between hemispheres. I can even say like, okay, give me 6 months and you will see this and this and this and this result.
Right.
And sometimes it's almost like supernatural kind of, okay, yes, I've read enough and I've tried enough things, but sometimes it's almost supernatural. And what you said, Scott, about patience, it's one of the core things because basically I operate on a attachment system and on a container system, right? Mm-hmm. Beyond's container. So what I can do, and parents sometimes can't do that because they have to take care of children's other needs and stuff like that. Right? But I don't, you know, I don't need to deal with food or school or whatever, right?
Right, right.
So I, for that hour that I'm with that child, I can be a perfect container.
Yeah.
I can, because I'm very patient, because I actually understand what's going on with this child, you know, and, you know, I don't need to take them to school, so I don't rush them or I don't scream at them, right?
Right.
So basically, I'm in a privileged position where I don't, you know, it's like, so I am patient enough to become their container and to become their safe space for this hour or 2 hours that I'm with them. So I'm able to reflect to them their current state, but also their desired state.
Right.
So, you know, so I work with rapport a lot and stuff like that. And you know, and I always get rewarded. There's never been any situation where I gave up on a child or a child gave up on me. Right. So in a way, the more I do it, the more I feel like it's a privilege, because I am so aware how much this work will affect this child in the future. And through this child, so many other people will be affected. Mm. And that's art. That, okay, art,
exactly.
50% art, 50% psychotherapy. So
right. Right. And there again, we're talking about when when you make sure that the two things are interconnected, both are great on their own, but when the two marry, I think that's where the real magic happens. Yes, and yes. Where human beings can find, yes, their full potential. So I'm going to turn to Scott. Like, I believe he has a degree in art. Is it art history?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yep. And psychology.
Wow. See, there you go. Yes. Well, yeah. I'm going to turn to you. Like, what effect has that had on your life?
The main effect, I would say, is it has enhanced my ability to see. Hmm. And by that, I mean to see beyond what's directly in front of me. I got really excited when Evelyn was talking about that combination, because at one point in my college career, I was on the verge of trying to almost develop a third major combining the two. So I started looking at the great artists of history in terms of their psychological makeup. A lot of that obviously is speculation, because we don't know what Van Gogh was thinking. We pretty good idea, and we know what he did. But in any given painting, that's a direct reflection of not only what the artist was seeing, but what he was feeling about what he was seeing. And this is true even in the less, you know, like when we talk about feeling in art, we tend to focus on the impressionists and the post-impressionists and stuff. But you look at a painting by Caravaggio, who is a Renaissance painter, slightly after the big three, after like Raphael and Michelangelo and Leonardo came Caravaggio. And his art is so photorealistic that you almost wonder where he came from, because the people who were painting, you know, great art at the same time, you could tell it was a painting. It was meant to look like a painting. Hmm. This guy was doing stuff that was meant to look like what your eye sees. Yet at the same time, he was doing things like he did an altarpiece, which was lost during the war, of St. Matthew writing his gospel. And St. Matthew was known to not be a very well-educated person. So in his painting of St. Matthew, he's struggling to write. So here's a photorealistic painting from 500 years ago that gives me a direct emotion that I can relate to, because I struggle to write every time I sit down to do it. Yeah. You know, that's kind of a funny thing for a guy who makes a living as a writer to say, but you know, there is an element every time I sit down to write of, I don't know if I can do this. Right. Then I start writing and I'm like, oh yeah, I guess I can, you know, yeah. But that connection was very real to me during my time as a college student, that, yeah, this really made a difference in each of these artists' work.
And then that's a hallmark of art too, is that it can bridge centuries,
yep.
You know, so we can look at something or hear music that was composed hundreds of years ago, and it touches the same things inside of us that presumably it touched back then.
Right.
Like, when that's part of the, yeah, that's like the magic of it. That
connection
human
and reflection. Connection and reflection are the main purposes of arts, right? The, the art can reflect what others can feel, right?
Right.
And it connect us. And by the way, thinking of Caravaggio, and I want to make a comeback to Leonardo, because I want to make a point about being a Renaissance person. Mm-hmm. But Caravaggio, wasn't he accused of murder?
Yeah, yes, he was. He was kind of a hothead.
Yes.
And yeah, he supposedly killed someone in a duel.
So that you see, if you connect kind of writing, psychology and art, then it opens up so much space into character study.
Yep.
And I'm always interested in the personality of a creator. I always ask, who was this person to be able to create something like this? What was his identity as a potential murderer? What did it have to do with him developing that type of art, that type of technique? Because guilt, shame, pain are a bit more often than not instrumental parts of development. Trauma is a building block on which the greatest brains often build things, right? So that's why we sometimes have to be careful in eliminating trauma, because it holds so much drive, so much motivation, so much aspiration is held in a traumatic experience. And I wonder that, because for some bizarre reason, I was reading about Caravaggio recently, and I was wondering, synchronicity is always there. Right. And I was wondering about how much it played, you know, how much it affected him, you know, as much as Mendelssohn was affected by being bipolar,
right?
And he wouldn't be as good a composer if he wasn't bipolar. Right. And then I want to circle back to Leonardo being a Renaissance man. And what I recently started, like lots of people call me a Renaissance woman, because I like the interdisciplinary connections. I do not believe in our world we can be just one thing anymore.
Right.
I believe that we have to maintain connections between a few sphere of influences, a few sphere of interest, a few sphere of development, education, stuff like that. So all my knowledge comes from the interdisciplinary skills between something, between subjects, rather than pure focus on something. And very often people are not encouraged to move between a few different spheres, not even subjects, spheres, right? Yep. But I think that is like the best thing that can happen, because, you know, you some of the biggest inventions of today come from the skills that are interdisciplinary skills, right?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
It's like it's being a Renaissance person.
I was just thinking in terms of just a simple way that music interfaces with the rest of my life, because I've never gotten to tell you, I am in my soul a musician. None of my talent lines up with that, you know, but I have the soul of a musician. So I connect to music on a very, very deep spiritual basis, but I also use it in little simple things. Like when I'm doing the dishes, I find if I'm listening to music, I get into a rhythm with the dishes. Oh. And the next thing I know, I'm done. Whereas if I was just sitting there going, I hate these stinking dishes, you know, and it's not just the pleasure I get from the music. It's that it actually is making my body work differently.
Circles back around to art giving us that ability to become maybe what we're destined to be, if there's such a thing. I don't really know, but the problem I see also with the current system and where I fear it's going is that you go through the school system, for example, and they're like, okay, here's who you are and this is what you're to do. Whereas the artist comes along and says, no, I want to do something else.
Right.
And they defy the system. We've seen this throughout history, you know, artists saying, you know, bucking the system and saying, I'm going to do something that's unpopular, in some cases illegal, et cetera.
Right.
And they create major change. And Evelina said something interesting, how trauma so often births brilliance. I mean, look at the Renaissance, for example. And there is a part of me that hopes that some of the difficulties we're facing now will result in some sort of modern Renaissance of people who have taken this time and turned to art to get them through it. And I would love to see us experience a resurgence of art in all of its forms. I think if that could be the result, that could be a fantastic thing. But thank you so much, Evelina, for joining us on today's Good Sentences. This has been a fantastic discussion, even though I had nothing of value to add. I'm glad I had two very talented people here with me, so I managed to skate by. It didn't matter.
But you know, you provided the framework framework. Yes, and that's as important as the content.
No, thank you. You're very kind. All in all, fantastic for both of you to have been here. I do appreciate it. And we'll see everybody next time.